from the Talking History, the radio voice of the Organization of American Historians. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. The nation celebrates Flag Day this week, on June 14th, to be exact, and we decided to mark the event by interviewing the author of a new book on the Pledge of Allegiance, Richard Ellis. In a moment, I'll speak with Ellis about how some 23 words that later became 31, written for a children's magazine in 1892, became such an immutable part of American life. After that, Fiona Beatty will join us to tell us about a museum where we can learn more about the Star-Spangled Banner, and Bruce Kuklick will conclude the show with his thoughts on what he calls the future of the past. But first, let's take a look at a couple of recent articles on history in the news you may have missed. Presidential blunders are very much in the news lately, and now a group of historians has been surveyed by the University of Louisville's McConnell Center to identify what they think were the 10 worst presidential blunders of all time. The worst, they concluded, was President James Buchanan's failure to avert the Civil War. Second on the list was Andrew Johnson's decision just after the Civil War to side with Southern whites to oppose radical Reconstruction of the South. Lyndon Johnson earned the third spot by allowing the Vietnam War to intensify. Woodrow Wilson came in fourth for refusing to compromise on the Treaty of Versailles after World War I. Number five went to Richard Nixon for his involvement in the Watergate cover-up. James Madison came in sixth for his failure to keep the U.S. out of the War of 1812, while Thomas Jefferson scored number seven for his Embargo Act of 1807. John Kennedy earned the eighth slot for the Bay of Pigs invasion. Ronald Reagan came in ninth for the Iran-Contra affair, while Bill Clinton rounded out the top ten for the Monica Lewinsky scandal, which scholars say probably affected his presidency more than it did American history and the public. So why do such a listing? According to political scientist and McConnell Center director Gary Gregg, we can probably learn just as much, or maybe even more, by looking at the mistakes of our presidents rather than looking at why they were great. Perhaps so. And in another listing, attendees at this year's meeting of the American Sociological Association ranked the most essential, as they put it, American protest songs of the past five decades. On the list were such standards as the civil rights song We Shall Overcome, Bob Dylan's The Times They Are A-Changing, and the 1930s union anthem Which Side Are You On? Others include the hip-hop Fight the Power by Public Enemy, Respect by Otis Redding, but performed by Aretha Franklin, of course, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud by James Brown, I Ain't Marching Anymore by Phil Oakes, Strange Fruit by Abel Maripol, but best known for its performance by Billie Holiday, and Lift Every Voice and Sing, written by James Weldon Johnson as an antidote to America the Beautiful. When we return, I'll speak with Richard Ellis about the history of the Pledge of Allegiance. Fiona Beatty will tell us about a museum devoted to the Star-Spangled Banner, and Bruce Kuklick will offer us his thoughts on the current state of the historical profession. This is Talking History.
Bear strange fruit.
For many Americans, the Pledge of Allegiance is an immutable part of an unchanging tradition that dates back to the nation's founding, a tradition seamlessly woven together by unbroken traditions and timeless traditions. So writes our guest this week, Richard Ellis, who goes on to show in his new book, To the Flag, that although this understanding of the past may be in the realm of ahistorical myth, in fact, the true history of the Pledge of Allegiance is far more interesting and complex, and I would add, more instructive. Richard Ellis is the Mark O. Hatfield Professor of Politics at Willamette University in Salem, Oregon. Welcome, Richard.
It's good to be here.
Right. Perhaps one way to begin our consideration of the ahistorical myth to which you refer is to address the importance of the American flag in our history and the origins of the Pledge of Allegiance. Now, let's skip over the usual discussion of the origins of the flag and the historical accuracy of the Betsy Ross story, and begin with your point that the public display of the American flag was not common until the Civil War. You quote an 1880 text, "When the Stars and Stripes went down at Sumter, they went up in every town in the loyal states." Explain that.
Well, as hard as it is for us to imagine this today, there was a time when the American flag was not the central political symbol that it is today. In the early Republic, the primary use of the flag was actually to identify naval vessels at sea, and it wasn't until the Civil War that the flag, at least in the North, really comes into its own as the preeminent symbol of American national identity, and it becomes something that you would see in private homes and in public schools. And after the Civil War, that patriotic ardor cools, people stop flying the flag, schools stop putting the flag up, and people get concerned about that declining prominence of the flag, and they think back nostalgically to the days of the Civil War when the flag waved, and there's an effort that comes out of that to place a flag over every schoolhouse in the nation in the late 1880s.
Okay, now, similarly, people might initially think that the Pledge of Allegiance itself must have also been authored at the origins of the nation's history soon after the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution, but that was not authored until 1892, well over a century after the nation's founding, and even then it was written for a children's magazine, Youth Companion, by someone who at least at first glance seems like a very unlikely candidate for the authorship. Tell us about Francis Bellamy.
Francis Bellamy was born and raised in a small town in New York, and from a devoutly religious family, he had a fanatical interest in genealogy. He could trace his family tree back to the 17th century, and he was particularly proud that his great-great-grandfather was Joseph Bellamy, who was a celebrated 18th-century Puritan divine. He was also the cousin of Edward Bellamy, who was author of the famous utopian novel Looking Backward, which was published shortly before that. Like his father, Bellamy was a Baptist minister, and his teachings were somewhat radical. Christian socialist is how he would describe himself at the time, and he was giving sermons on things like Jesus the Socialist, which proved a little too radical for some of his genteel parishioners at Boston's Bethany Baptist Church, and so he resigns his post in 1891, and fortunately for him, one of his parishioners is a wealthy man by the name of Daniel Sharp Ford, who is the owner of the Youth's Companion, the magazine you mentioned. And Bellamy is offered a job by Ford to work with this magazine, even though Bellamy has no journalistic experience. And at the time, the Youth's Companion is spearheading this effort to coordinate a nationwide celebration of public schools to mark the 400th anniversary of the discovery of America by Columbus. And the centerpiece of that day's ceremonies was to be the raising of an American flag over every schoolhouse in the nation, and Bellamy was handed the responsibility of pulling together that program that was to be followed by every public school, and Bellamy wrote the Pledge of Allegiance for that program.
Okay, so he wrote it as part of his campaign to erect a flag, and it was tied to the 400th anniversary of Columbus's landing in the Americas. But you also suggest in your book that Bellamy and others may have been motivated by some anxiety over the rapidly growing number of immigrants entering the United States at the end of the 19th century.
That's right. The 1880s and 1890s were, of course, a period of rapid growth in immigration, and like today, it produced acute anxiety about America's future, particularly among native-born Protestants like Bellamy. But it wasn't just the increase in the number of immigrants that worried Bellamy and those like him, but the change in who was coming. And rather than immigrants coming mostly from Northern and Western Europe, as had been true in most of the 19th century, these new immigrants were coming from Southern and Eastern Europe, and they were generally Catholic and Jewish rather than Protestant. The same anxiety you can see today, the anxiety isn't just about the numbers of immigrants, but about who's coming. And it's that anxiety about immigration that is, I argue, largely responsible for the creation of the Pledge of Allegiance. No immigration, no Pledge of Allegiance.
Did he see it as a creed, if you will, that people could welcome and embrace, or did he hope that every immigrant would simply say this pledge and instantly become Americans? What did he hope he would accomplish with this?
The pledge is very interesting. For the immigrants, he, like a lot of people, they felt like they couldn't reach the adults, but the children they could reach. So by appealing to the children of immigrants, you could mold and make Americans. And in that respect, while Bellamy is anti-immigrant or fearful of immigrants, he's not the same kind of fearfulness that in the 1920s results in us putting up a gate against immigrants and saying no more coming in. We're still letting them in, and there's still confidence that they can be remade, at least the young amongst the immigrants, that they can be remade.
Good. Okay. You also mentioned there's a concern with Bellamy and others, again, with the materialism and individualism of, we call it the Gilded Age.
Yeah, immigration's important, but it's not the only anxiety that late 19th century Americans like Bellamy have. And he also worries a great deal about materialism and selfishness of the society. And this is a problem he believed that native-born Americans had, that they were interested only in the quick buck, in individual advancement, and they didn't have the same spirit of patriotic self-sacrifice that Civil War veterans had shown. And not coincidentally, in the ceremony, the flag-raising ceremony, it's the Civil War veteran that raises the flag while the students give the Pledge of Allegiance. And in Bellamy's eyes, the Civil War generation, the Civil War veterans, were the greatest generation, to use our locution, and much as we look wistfully back to World War II vets as the greatest generation, so Bellamy looked back to the Civil War generation as the greatest generation, and the current generation was only interested in me and making money, and that worried him a great deal.
An interesting point. Okay, so how and when did this copy, if you will, in a popular children's magazine become a national pledge as we know it today?
Very slowly. Actually, Bellamy's pledge is written for a single occasion, and he didn't really expect it to be said on a regular or routine basis. I think he was as surprised as anyone that it caught on. But patriotic groups recognized that if you were going to instill patriotism, you needed regular rituals. One-time events weren't going to do it. So over the next several decades, these groups, various patriotic and veterans groups, pressed legislatures and school boards around the country to require the flying of the flag, to teach flag etiquette, to the teaching of the Constitution and civics. Public schools are no longer just about the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic. It's a place for teaching patriotism. And you have a number of different pledges out there. There's another one called the Balch Salute, which went, "We give our hands and our hearts to God and our country, one language, one flag." And that was used in New York City schools, especially at the elementary level, throughout the early 20th century. And it's only really with World War I where you get a strong pressure to standardize flag etiquette and to standardize the flag salute that finally it's the case that Bellamy's pledge becomes the preeminent pledge. And by the time Bellamy dies in 1931, the pledge has become a defining symbol of national patriotism in a way that it wasn't in the early 20th century.
Okay, the original pledge had only 23 words. Today it's got 31. Let me just read the original, and we can talk about a few of the phrases. "I pledge allegiance to my flag and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all." Now, we don't have time to talk about all of this and some of the changes that have been made, but let's just talk about a few because you make some interesting points in your book. For example, about the change from my flag to the flag in the 1920s.
That happens in the 1923 Flag Conference, and it's hosted by the Daughters of the American Revolution, spearheaded by the American Legion, includes representatives from almost all of the nation's major patriotic and veterans groups. The aim of that conference is to agree on a flag code that would govern how Americans would pay their respect to the flag. One of the things they do is endow Bellamy's pledge with the status of the nation's pledge. And the other thing they do is change the pledge from my flag to the flag of the United States, and in the following year they add of America. But the change is motivated by a fear that the problem with my flag is that the children of immigrants who are saluting the flag will be secretly or inadvertently pledging allegiance to the flag of the old country. They're going to be, they're looking at the flag, but they're actually pledging allegiance to some different flag. And so this was to clarify that my flag meant that flag that was sitting right in front of you, the American flag.
That's a good one. Okay, the phrase is indivisible and allegiance. What was the meaning, the original context for those words?
Well, indivisible certainly explicitly invoked the Civil War, and it spoke to Bellamy's concerns about social divisions in the industrialized late 19th century that he saw, and his desire to promote national unity in the face of class and group conflict. And the word allegiance also harkens back to the Civil War and its aftermath, when, after all, Southerners were required to take an oath of allegiance before they could be released from prison, for instance, or vote or hold political office. So they're both backward-looking words that are connecting the United States back to the Civil War.
And what about the phrase, with liberty and justice for all?
I guess if there's a phrase that bears some trace of Bellamy's Christian socialist commitments, it's that phrase there. He said, many years later at least, that he originally thought of saying liberty, equality, and fraternity, borrowing it from the French Revolution. That might not be too popular today, but he decided that would be too controversial. And he decided that liberty and justice for all was preferable because it would appeal to Americans of all parties and persuasions.
Okay, probably the best known addition, because it's so controversial today, is the phrase under God, added in 1954. What was that all about?
Again, the reason it's added is, again, an anxiety. And in this case, it's an anxiety about the fight against communism. And adding under God is explicitly a way of putting the pledge at the service of the fight against communism. At the end of the Cold War, the threat that the communists posed to the United States was largely a military one. But in the early years of the Cold War, communism was seen as a rival for the allegiance of the people in the United States and across the world. The United States stood for liberty and justice, but the communists claimed to stand for justice and equality too. And people worried that communism could instill a fierce, fanatical even, loyalty that the West couldn't match. And so many people came to think that to match that commitment required recommitting the nation to its religious roots. It was religion, the belief in God, that really differentiated the United States from the godless, atheistic communists. And so the anxieties of the early years of the Cold War spawn a revival of interest in religion in the public sphere in this country, and the pledge is just one example of the attempt to inject religion into the public sphere in order to distinguish us, the United States, from the communists.
Now, that phrase has been challenged, most recently by Michael Newdow, who I think is probably best known to our listeners, but it's been challenged in the past, and Newdow's challenge actually was thrown out on a technicality, but he's back. Do you think that the challenge to the phrase under God is going to have any traction, if you will, with the Supreme Court?
My guess is the answer is no. I think many lawyers will tell you that Michael Newdow's argument is the more compelling one if you look at the precedents of constitutional law, in particular the precedent of the coercion test, which was laid down in a case called Levy-Weissman, which said that the state can't place students in the untenable position of choosing between participating in an exercise with religious content or protesting against that. And the Levy-Weissman case involves a non-sectarian prayer at a public school graduation, and I think there's a pretty good case that could be made that if the non-sectarian blessing in Lee was unconstitutional, as the Supreme Court said it was, that under God is too. After all, children who say the pledge are younger and more impressionable, grade school students versus high school students, the pledge is said every day or every week, not once in a student's school career. Kids are required to be at public school. They're not required to be at graduation. The pledge is led by a teacher or principal, the state, in other words, versus the Lee case where it was led by a clergyman. But one of the things that strikes me is that the backers of the pledge tie themselves into all sorts of intellectual knots trying to explain why the pledge doesn't violate the Establishment Clause. They say it's a description of what the founders believed rather than a statement of what the nation aspires to be, or that it's really an all-inclusive God that includes everybody, even non-believers, or the inclusion of the term is really so insignificant that the violation, if there is one, is de minimis, insignificant, which leaves it a great mystery why it is that everyone gets so worked up about the Ninth Circuit Court ruling in 2002. But the court is a political body as much or more than an intellectual or logical one, and I'd be stunned if they found under God to be unconstitutional. Even those sympathetic to Newdow's argument, I think, will fear that such a ruling might invite a constitutional amendment not to allow God in the pledge, but even would go further to prayer in the public schools, perhaps. So a decision against the Under God Clause could conceivably put the entire body of Establishment Clause jurisprudence in question. And so my guess is the Supreme Court will uphold the Under God Clause in the narrowest possible terms, while Thomas and Scalia will write concurring opinions that argue for a sweeping rethinking of Establishment Clause jurisprudence, but I don't think that will carry the day either.
Okay. Well, we only have time for one last question. So let me take you to a point you, if you come under fire, it might very well be for your conclusion here. You make clear that the pledge has not only inspired us as a people, but also been used to promote conformity and silence dissent. But you also write, backers of the pledge are often cast as true patriots, but it's arguably those who would dispense with a daily pledge who are the ones who harbor the greatest faith in the enduring power and strength of American institutions and American ideas. Perhaps that is the true paradox of the Pledge of Allegiance. You better defend that one. What do you mean by it?
My point here, and it's meant to be provocative, but my point here is only that the pledge pushers often betray an anxiety about the American future that seems at odds with their boasts about the greatness of America. It's hard not to notice that it's those who've been most fearful about threats to American national identity and the American future who've been the ones who've been most insistent on patriotic rituals. And one of the arguments that I make in the book is that in a way, the pledge is less an expression about a confidence in the greatness of America than it is an expression of an anxiety that America won't be great enough to withstand threats. And if one's confident in the enduring power of American ideals and institutions to secure the loyalty of its citizens, as I am, why insist on having children, other people's children, reaffirm their allegiance to the state on a daily basis? That's really the point I'm trying to make there.
Great. Thank you, Richard. It's a good book. I hope people will pick it up because we're bound to have more political conversation and pundits will comment on Newdow's case. And this is a good book to get a good objective background on what's happening. So thanks again for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
I've been speaking with Richard Ellis, Marco Hatfield Professor of Politics at Willamette University in Salem, Oregon, and the author of To the Flag, The Unlikely History of the Pledge of Allegiance, published by the University of Kansas Press. And this is Talking History. Closely associated with the Pledge of Allegiance, about which we just heard, is the Star-Spangled Banner. Fiona Beatty joins us to tell us where we can learn much more about the venerable old flag.
The original Star-Spangled Banner, with its 15 stars and stripes, painstakingly crafted by Mary Pickersgill in 1813 with the help of her daughter, hangs in the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History. However, visitors to the Star-Spangled Banner Museum in Baltimore will see a glass replica of the 30-by-42-foot flag in the Great Flag Window. In addition, visitors will find an orientation theatre and exhibits on the American flag, Mary Pickersgill, and the War of 1812. Visitors to the adjacent Flag House Museum are given a personalised tour of Pickersgill's 18th century home. The museums provide extensive living history programmes for visiting school groups, as well as family-orientated programmes, including open-hearth cooking demonstrations and quilt conservation workshops. Cyber visitors will not be disappointed. There's an extensive links page where the curious can read extended histories of the creation of the flag, the War of 1812, or the Battle of Baltimore and the War of 1812. They can learn how the defense of Fort McHenry inspired Francis Scott Key to write the famed Star-Spangled Banner. There are numerous links to sites of further interest, including the Smithsonian Institution, Baltimore's Homewood House Museum, Mount Clair Museum House, and the Society of the War of 1812. There's also an audio file of the Star-Spangled Banner, as it was sung at President George Bush's, the Elder's, inauguration in 1989. Images of the flag, and of special interest this week, a link to the National Flag Day Foundation. To find out for yourself, go to flaghouse.org.
And finally, as promised, Bruce Kuklick joins us to offer us his thoughts on what he calls the mass professionalization of history and its effect on teaching and research in the field. Kuklick is the Nichols Professor of American History at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of 9 books, including To Every Season on Baseball and Blind Oracles, Intellectuals and War from Kennan to Kissinger. But he's also won 4 major teaching awards given by the university.
What most concerns me about being a historian today is what I call mass professionalization. a very large number of people trained to be professional historians, to publish in ever more specialized journals, to avoid undergraduate teaching, and to engage in their own research agendas. Mass professionalization means that we have fewer efficient means at our disposal for authoritatively evaluating historical work. In the old days, standards may have been narrow and rigid, but at least one knew who to read, and the number of historians was limited enough so that the supply of books did not so entirely exceed one's ability to consume. History now has 1,000 flowers blooming. It is a big tent. My fear is the number of flowers and the size of the tent. There's so much out there, and so many of us are struggling to get recognition for what we do, that we have little sense of the outlines of even large fields and of what is worth reading. We don't have much of a handle on what we do or how we are doing it. Mass professionalization influences the role of history in American society. Part of our job is that we collectively maintain a sense of the past. Professionals do this through endeavors like popular history writing, the History Channel, and historical movies and documentaries. These media are flourishing, but there's an enormous gap between the many things that intrigue the profession and the obsession of the public with great men and big battles. I'm not entirely opposed to this obsession, but I do think that the history-interested public would be better served if there were a closer match between its concerns and the priorities and standards of professionals, so we could more seriously influence what attracts the public and how the attractions are presented. As matters stand now, there seems to me to be two diverging paths, the popular and the professional, and I don't believe that's healthy. Let me, in conclusion, turn away from the problems to a connected matter, where I would like us to direct our efforts in the future. I'd like to see far more of an accent on the way we can make our priorities cogent to a collegiate public. Crucially, how we can do a better job in undergraduate teaching. We need a more coherent history curriculum with more stress on a series of basic courses that offer a broad introduction to the national and international historical setting of our lives. We need fewer seminars on narrow topics for undergraduates and less weight on research for undergraduates. We need more discussion courses and a graded writing program that would increase in difficulty with an increase in the level of courses. We need more faculty willing to teach seminars for freshmen and fresh women. We need more seasoned faculty to teach survey courses. We need fewer graduate students competing with undergraduates for time with faculty, and fewer graduate students substituting for faculty in classrooms. That is, we need to do more to train our students to be educated citizens.
You've been listening to Bruce Kuklick, Nichols Professor of American History at the University of Pennsylvania. And that's it for this week's Talking History. We remind you that Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, that Fiona Beatty is our producer and Alex Smith our studio engineer, that the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect those of the Talking History staff or of the OEH, and that to learn more about Talking History, all you need do is visit our website at oeh.org. We welcome your comments on this show and suggestions for future programs. Just email them to us at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or mail them to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Until next week, thank you for listening. This is your host, Brian LeBeau.